Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and this special Memorial Day weekend edition of the program. You'll have the opportunity to participate in Memorial Day events in your community, I'm sure. But one way to make every day like Memorial Day is for us to seek to live in a way that assigns a value to our freedom that matches the price that has been paid to secure and preserve it. The wars in Iraq and Afghanistan in recent decades have claimed nearly 7,000 American lives. There are more than 58,000 names on the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Wall in Washington, D.C. And the Korean War Veterans Memorial is currently in the process of adding the names of more than 36,000 killed during that conflict. World War I saw more than 116,000 die in the service of our country, and back in the Civil War, more than 600,000 between the two sides. One number you'll hear me cite quite frequently on this show is 406,000, long considered the approximate number of Americans who died while serving in World War II. The Stories Behind the Stars project estimates that number could be as high as 421,000. And again, Stories Behind the Stars is working to tell the personal stories of each one of them. If you were to go to storiesbehindthestars.org and sign up right now to become another volunteer contributing to that effort, you could get a head start through the memories of Al Finley, who spent his final years on Earth as a docent at the Central Coast Veterans Memorial Museum in San Luis Obispo, California. If you were to visit there today, you can still find a plaque bearing Al's name on the wall, bordering his plaque on all four sides. Plaques with the names of four members of his B-24 crew, all four Gold Star heroes.
Well, on the 26th mission, we'd been to the target had been Magdeburg. And we'd been to the target and bombed Magdeburg, and we were on a return trip. We were flying over the Ruhr Valley. We flew through a flak shield. I don't think it was there all the time. I think it must have just started about the time we got there. Oof. Anyway, we got hit at number one engine and set it on fire. We were hit in the rear part of the aircraft. So I got out of my position. Wasn't far to between the pilot and co-pilot. I think our interphone was out the same way, the reason I did that. The engineer got out of it. He flew the Upper Martin turret, and he got out of the turret, and we were both standing by the pilot and the co-pilot, and the pilot said, "Bill, the engineer, go back to the rear and check the controls back there." He said, I can't control the airplane."
So maybe the cables to the rudder had been severed or damaged?
Yes. Okay. So Bill went back to the bomb bay and went back to the rear and gone a very short time, and he came back and said that the controls were cut. And also all three gunners had been wounded and they're in bad condition. And then he said, "I'm going to go back and take them." And I said, "Work over them, you know." And I said, "I'll go back with you too." And as I turned to go, the pilot grabbed my arm and said, "Al, start throwing everything over out of the bomb bay that you can. The flak suits, the flak helmets, even if you get your radios loose. But I can't hold the altitude." So I started doing that. And first thing I know, I look back up and the co-pilot was standing up, getting his parachute. And he said, "Bail out, bail out." So I grabbed my chute. And it was a chest chute and hooked it on my chute. I took my GI boots that was beside me, and as I went out, I put them on the catwalk. Then I bailed out, and I left my shoes on the catwalk. But anyway, I was so low that we were so low that I saw two sheets come out after I went. I didn't see the airplane crash. I saw the airplane kind of climb and fall off, but I never did see it crash because when I hit the ground, I hit it so hard it knocked me out, and I was unconscious for I don't know how long laying there. And when I woke up, there were three German, I assume they were farmers, standing over me. Two of them had pitchforks, and the other one had a gun. Again, I was so kind of woozy, I didn't really know what was going on, you know. The one with the gun pointed at my head, you know, and I thought, I bought the farm, you know. And then he turned the gun away and fired it, and then started laughing. And then I must have passed out again, because the next thing I knew, I was in a farmhouse. One of them was there, and a woman was there, and somebody had taken my wristwatch and my dog tags. They'd gone through my clothes, you know. I tried to ask how I got there, and they showed me a wheelbarrow. They'd put me in a wheelbarrow and rolled me in a wheelbarrow to where it was. It was after dark when somebody came back with the police and took us to the local jail. I say us. It took me to the local jail, but the others were in the jail. There were the co-pilot and the navigator and the nose gunner. The pilot wasn't there because they didn't see his chute open, and he was loose in the country for about 2 weeks before he turned himself in. But there was the nose gunner and myself, the co-pilot, and the navigator.
So that's four of you there at that jail.
There was five of them. Well, yeah, four of us. That's right. Because the pilot wasn't there. Okay, I'm trying to get five out of it.
Well, and the math, so everybody listening understands, you had nine men on the plane.
The Bombardier wasn't flying then, because what they had done was take the nose gunner, and as the lead aircraft would drop their bombs, he would toggle the bomb. So we lost the Bombardier, really.
So you've got a nine-man crew.
Yes.
And you talked about the three gunners in the back being wounded.
Yes.
They all went down with the plane?
They all went down with the plane, plus the engineer went down with the plane, and there was nothing wrong. He got caught back there.
He was back trying to help them.
That's right.
And it cost him his
life.
So
nobody knows how bad they were injured or what was going on in the rear of the aircraft, but Bill, the engineer, and he went down.
Did you guys know that at the time? That they had not survived?
Well, we'd known that they'd gone. We didn't know that, but assumed the airplane crashed. We didn't know they'd be killed. We didn't know that till the Germans told us.
You mentioned how hard you hit the ground because you had to bail out at such low altitude.
Yes, yes.
You hit it so hard it knocked you unconscious. Did you have injuries as a result of that?
Just my back, the lower part of my back. It was hard. It was hard for me to sit down, so I hurt the lower part, tailbone or something.
But when you find yourself at this jail and you see some familiar faces, yes. That had to mean a lot to you to see them.
That's right, yes. My navigator, Rock Kramer, could understand a little German, but he didn't let them know that he understood German, you know. But anyway, he told us, he said, don't say anything about Magdeburg. He said, one of these fellows has got a mother or something that lives in where we just bombed, you know. Ooh. So he said, don't say anything about Magdeburg.
Yeah, and you can laugh about it now. Yeah, but at the time, right. I'm sure there was a real fear that these people could kill you.
Yes, there was a real fear, yes. Yeah. We spent one night in the jail, the local jail, and then the next afternoon, an officer, I think a lieutenant in the Luftwaffe, and a sergeant came to pick us up. He had a machine gun that he carried. They put us on a passenger train, and we went to Essen, which was a town in the Ruhr Valley. About the time we got there, the British were starting with bombing. So they took us off the train and took us down to the underground. A lot of civilians were there at that time, and they didn't care much for us. And they kind of started walking towards us, you know. The officer said something to the sergeant, and he pulled up his machine gun, and they backed away. But so it was just that way until the bombing was over, and then we went up, got back on the train, and it's very kind of vague now. I don't know what it took a day or 2 days to get to Oberursel, which is the interrogation center. I was in solitary confinement for 11 days, and the navigator was in solitary confinement for 13 days, and the other... Let's see, Smitty was a nose gunner, and they let him go early. The pilot wasn't there yet. He was still running around loose in the country. But I was there for 11 days, and then they put me on a boxcar on the train.
Before we hear about that,
okay,
11 days there in solitary with not a lot to eat or drink, probably not even that much room to stretch out in, I would imagine, huh?
I had a bucket for a toilet, and I had a straw mattress. Not much more in there, no.
And what about the actual
interrogation. What kinds of things did they try to get out of you?
Well, it wasn't not what I thought, though. They wanted to know about the V2 bombs, what the English were thinking of, you know, how much of a damage it's causing in England, actual damage, and then, you know, if it's the people are scared and stuff like that. But as far as military, I had very few questions about that because he knew more about my outfit than I did.
I've heard a lot of guys say that.
Yeah, he knew more my commanding officer's name, et cetera, et cetera. But they'd got it from previous people, I guess, you know. But most of my interrogation was not sensible questions, you know. They were just like they about the British, et cetera, et cetera. And do you think the war is going to be over soon, you know? My interrogator was a Captain Rubel.
And how was his English?
Good. Very excellent English, yes, yeah.
A lot of those interrogators they had spent a lot of time in the States.
Yeah.
Well, and you said they asked you, when do you think the war is going to be over? Again, I'm thinking about you. This is February 1945. You don't know that the war is going to be over in 3 months.
No, I don't know.
I mean, I imagine the future had to be a real uncertain thing for you at that point.
Well, it would have to be, yeah.
And how did you handle that? How did you deal with that reality that, hey, I may never get out of captivity or I may die in captivity?
I don't think that ever involved I never thought of that, you know, because looking back when we were hauling gasoline to Pat, they were moving so fast against the Germans. They're running, you know, in other words, their supplies couldn't keep up with them. So it wouldn't be too long, you know. We were told that not to try to escape because the war is going to be over pretty soon. So they took away our guns so we couldn't get in trouble. That just implied that, well, you know, it's not going to be long now.
That said, there was plenty of trouble for you in the months that followed and even in the days. So you mentioned 11 days there at the interrogation center, and then they put you on another one of these 40 and 8s packed in with a bunch of other POWs.
Yes.
How tightly were you packed?
You couldn't sit down. You had to stand. You had to stand. It wasn't too far to Wetzlar. And like I say, it was a transit camp because I'd been in my flying clothes for all this time, 11 or 12 days. I hadn't shaved. I hadn't showered. I was still wearing my flying boots. And so at Wetzlar, we got a shower, shave, and change of clothes. I think maybe the Red Cross had something to do with it, you know. But I got boots and et cetera, and was there about, I guess I was there about 3 days. And then they put us back on the boxcars, again, crammed in like sardines. And we hadn't gone too far that day, and we got attacked by our own fighters, and they strafed we were just crammed in there. And
so everyone understands, you're on this boxcar, and you know from a lot of your missions, a lot of the targets are railroads and marshalling lines.
Oh, yes.
And they're trying to take out the supplies before they get to the front line. They don't know what's in these boxcars.
That's right.
So your own American planes are shooting the boxcar that you're in.
That's right.
And you saw people get hit.
Yes. I know there were several casualties, yeah. And the Germans finally opened the doors and let us out. And there was a forest right up to trees close to the track. And we were running for that. And the fighters saw that, I guess, and they stopped firing because they assumed it was either a troop train or carrying supplies or something, you know. It wasn't marked or anything. So they were probably shooting anything that moved in at that time.
Yeah. Boy, I can't imagine how scary that must be, how helpless a feeling that is.
You are helpless, yeah. You can't fight back. You can't do anything but run.
But you survived that.
Then went to Nuremberg, and Nuremberg was just packed with prisoners. Just terrible. Had lice, bed bugs, roaches, all that stuff.
And what'd you have to eat?
Very little. I have a piece of German bread that had tastes like sawdust. A soup invariably had little dead insects in it. That was about our food. Every once in a while, we would get some Red Cross parcels, but they'd puncture all the cans, so you had to eat them right away or let them spoil, you know. So they were pretty tricky on that. Nuremberg was another place that the British loved to bomb the Nuremberg, and our camp was very close to the town, and we would just bounce on them when they started bombing.
And what did your family know, if anything, about what had happened to you?
I don't think they knew anything, nothing.
Had you been reported missing? Did they get a telegram or anything?
Well, I didn't know at the time.
Right.
But later, they were told I was missing, and then when it was POW, they knew that I was a prisoner of war, yeah.
I'm just trying to imagine being in your shoes and how lonely and desperate and seemingly hopeless that scenario could be. I mean, you're on the other side of the world from your family. You've lost your freedom. You're not getting anything to eat. What was it that kept you going or kept your hope burning?
Well, a few prayers now and then I think didn't hurt, you know. You had somebody upstairs that was looking after you. So I felt pretty confident with that, you know. I'd always been somebody that I loved to go out fishing and camping and you know, live on my own, etc., like that. So I think a lot of that held over.
Your liberation didn't come there at the camp at Nuremberg. They had to move you because the lines were getting too close?
That's right, yes. We started on a march on leaving Nuremberg on the 4th of April in the afternoon. We hadn't gone too long, maybe 2 hours or something, and we were under a train trestle. And we got hit with three more American fighters. The first one strafed, and the second one started strafing and then stopped. And then the third one peeled off and didn't strike. So they must have recognized that we were POWs or something. Then after that, we had toilet paper, and we made a big sign out in a field, POW, you know. So, in other words, one plane saw that, because from then on, there was one plane that flew every day, would come and check on us, where we were, and et cetera. I'm glad they knew we were there and who we were.
I guess so, because otherwise there's nothing solid to hold on to. I mean, you don't know where you're going. You don't know how long it's going to take.
That's right.
You hadn't had much to eat. I have to think this was exhausting to be marching every day.
Yeah, and the weather was bad. It was raining, and it was really a bad trip. It took us about almost 2 weeks. I think we got to Moosburg in about somewhere around the 20th of April, I think. A week before we were liberated. I've felt kind of guilty all my life now since that I came so close. If it hadn't been for the pilot, I wouldn't be here. I came so close to going back there with Bill. I say it was a step away from death, you know.
So when Bill went back to help the wounded gunners, you were going to go with him, but the pilot said you need to start jettisoning stuff and making this plane lighter.
That's right.
But if he hadn't said that, you would have gone.
I would have gone. I'd taken one step to go when he grabbed my hat. So I was that close to death.
And you would have gone down with the plane.
Sure, yeah. Everything happened so fast, you know. You didn't have really time to think, you know. Bill's gone back. Nobody knows how the three in the rear were, you other than he. He went back the first to check the cables, and he's found them wounded. And then he came forward and told us, and then we went back right back again. And he was the only one on the crew that was married and had a child.
So when you say you felt guilty, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but what I think I hear you saying is that sometimes you wish you would have gone back and Bill would have survived.
Yes.
And do you know, were their bodies ever found?
Yes, they were buried. I've got some German papers and stuff that they sent me. When it was all declassified, the Air Force sent it to me, and it covers a lot of the period I was over there, and it did say where the men were buried. You know, when the pilot came in to camp and we saw him again, he didn't really know that all of them had been killed, you know. And so that broke him up too, you know. And he said that he was going to put Bill in for a medal when he got back to the States, because he should have got the Medal of Honor, really, back there tending to them, and gave his life doing that, you know.
Yeah. When you say you felt guilty about Bill, I'm wondering if you talk about the wonderful life you've had. Have you had a sense of trying to make the most of your life in light of what happened to Bill and those other three?
I think so. Like I say, I've had a guilty feeling ever since that happened. Maybe I shouldn't have, but I just couldn't get rid of it, you know. And I think when I got those plaques, I had a plaque put up on the wall about 2 years ago.
And we're talking right here where we're sitting at the Central Coast Veterans Memorial Museum. So there's a wall near the entrance with all these plaques that list the names of different servicemen. So you had your name put up there.
I had my name put up and my service up, yes.
So that'll be here long after you're gone.
That's right, that's right.
But then you had another idea.
Yes, I did. I decided that to get plaques for each one of those and have them positioned where each one touched my plaque, and that we would be back together again after 70-some years. And that's happened, and I think a big relief has been taken off of my shoulders for doing that.
That's not free. That costs some money to do that.
That's beside the point.
Well, that is my point,
okay.
Because what you got from doing that, from honoring those guys from your crew who aren't here anymore, sounds like that satisfaction and that maybe closure that you developed from that is priceless.
I do feel that way, yes.
Thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us this story. I'm pretty sure that Bill and those other three fallen brothers of yours would be really proud of what you're doing.
I hope so.
He no longer has to hope. Al Findlay passed away in 2019, and now he knows so. If you ever have the chance to visit the Central Coast Veterans Memorial Museum, look for those four names around his on the wall. Bill Fowler, Raleigh Murray, Theodore Mabee, and John Gates. Four Gold Star heroes we honor this Memorial Day, and four whom Al honored every day. This special Memorial Day edition of Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.